Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Salman Rushdie, whose latest novel is 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights. Salman Rushdie is the author of 13 novels at this point, including Midnight's Children, Satanic Verses, Shalimar the Clown, Enchantress of Florence. The most recent book was a young adult children's book, however you want to describe it, called Luca and the Fire of Life. This book is a fantasy with science fiction elements. The last time I spoke with you, which was about the memoir, Joseph Anton, you had said you were working on something for television. What happened?
It's like all these things have never happened. I mean, I learned a lot about Hollywood. You know, they tell you for 2 years that it's the most exciting thing they've ever heard about, and then 2 years later they say, we've decided not to go in that direction. But actually, there was one aspect of it that was helpful, because although it was very unlike this book, it was also a kind of parallel world story. You know, it was much more science fiction-y, actually, than this. But it was about two versions of the Earth, you know, that kind of come into collision with each other, two sort of alternative Earths, you know. And so I had actually been thinking a lot about this idea of alternate realities and having them come into collision with each other. So I, in a way, see that now as having been helpful preparatory work for this book.
At what point did you decide, okay, I'm going to sit down and finally get to another novel?
Well, really, after I'd worked a lot on that Showtime project, but also, you know, I'd been writing this memoir for several years, I sort of had an emotional reaction against nonfiction. I just thought, you know, enough with telling the truth. And it made me want to, it really pushed me imaginatively to like the other end of the spectrum, you know, and I thought, let me make up something wild. And then, as I say, the work that I'd been doing on the defunct television thing sort of fed into that. And also, you know, you mentioned Luca and the Fire of Life. I mean, these two books that I wrote for my boys, Luca and the earlier book, Harun and the Sea of Stories, had been really so enjoyable to do that I was thinking about that kind of writing, that kind of Arabian Nights fairy tale kind of writing. And of course, those stories originally, the old ones, were not written as children's stories. I mean, they were written for adults. And so I thought, what would happen if I start thinking about a grown-up story which uses some of the techniques of that wonderful motherload of stories, you know, and that is where it came from, really.
There's another element, too, that connects, which is underneath it all, behind it all, this is another novel about, like those two, about storytelling.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's this wonderful thing that Borges once said, where he said, I've always imagined that paradise would be a sort of library. I know what he means, because, you know, books come from the world, of course. They come from what we know about the world and what we experience of it, but they also come from other books. And I think I've become more and more aware as I've got older of the power of story, you know, because it seems to me that what happens is that we all of us, we don't have to be writers, you know, all of us, in a way, live through stories. You know, we tell each other stories of ourselves, or we learn family stories. We learn the stories of a community. We learn national stories. You know, we learn, and all these, you could say, concentric circles of stories, you know, with us at the middle, become our description of the world. It becomes the picture of the world that we live in, you know, and we use it every day in order to understand the world. And sometimes at moments of great change or disruption, the old stories don't seem to fit anymore, you know, and that induces a kind of panic.
And I keep thinking that if we substitute the word narrative for the word story,
yes,
then we're looking at what is happening in the United States today in the political campaigns,
yes,
where the old narratives are clearly not working.
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's interesting that it's not just in America, but in many places, you know, electorates, let's say, are having this very strong reaction against the traditional narrative. You know, the fact that in England, the Labour Party is about to choose a very maverick far-left figure as its new leader.
Is there any chance that person could get elected?
No. No. I mean, no, unless really the world has changed more than we think it has. I mean, it's in the same way as, is it possible for Bernie Sanders to get elected? Well, you know, conventional wisdom would say no. But it may be that conventional wisdom no longer applies. No, I mean, Donald Trump is the same thing. It's all a manifestation of people's dissatisfaction with the story as it's been told, you know, and people sense that they're being sold a line, they're sold a bill of goods.
Salman Rushdie, what's occurring to me as you're speaking, of course, is that when you've got the narrative of 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights, which roughly translated means 1,001 nights,
yes.
When you've got that and you're starting to dig into it and under the surface, yeah. What we're seeing is, in a sense, a parable about what you've just said.
Yeah, I mean, I thought, you know, one of the first, I mean, the first things I had were the idea of the jinn, of genies, as a kind of disruptive force in the world, you know, to be a metaphor of many disruptions, but also just kind of fun. And I had the idea of Mr. Geronimo the gardener coming detached from the earth. You know, and I mean, just half an inch detached, you know, which I think the funny thing is that to be half an inch, floating half an inch above the ground is just as great a breach of the law of gravity as being 20 feet up in the air, but more amusing. But I started with that, and then I found myself thinking about what we've just been talking about. And I thought, many people, I think, now have this sense of the rules of the world having changed in some way that we don't really fully comprehend, you know. And the old rules don't seem to work. And I'm not just talking about politics. I'm talking also about technology and, you know, the kind of enormous revolution in information and so on. I mean, I find myself endlessly having to Google things to find out what all these new acronyms mean, you know. And yet there are people who use them in a kind of everyday way and seem completely familiar with them. I have to learn, you know, it's quite interesting to have to learn new slang, but there is a lot of new slang at the moment. But I just have this sense that people, there's a bewilderment, you know, that the world isn't working according in the way that it's supposed to. And we don't know what the new rules are. And I thought, if I could dramatize that in some way, wouldn't it be interesting to come up with a portrait of a moment in which all the rules, I mean, starting with the law of gravity, aren't really applying or are only imperfectly applying?
So on some level, you start with one idea, and that broadens into all of these other ideas.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I first started thinking about this book, I really thought it might just be about Mr. Geronimo the gardener coming detached from the world, you know. Right. I thought it could be a kind of Kafkaesque little story, you know. Gregor Samsa turns into a bug, you know. Mr. Geronimo starts to rise from the earth. And maybe it was just that. And then it was really only in just thinking about the world in which he would be set, you know, that I began to think of this larger fable.
And, of course, as it's happening, the world is fitting into that. You started this after Sandy, though.
Yeah, I was here. I mean, I was living in New York at the time of the hurricane. So, of course, I experienced the hurricane and was in the blackout area. You know, I mean, this where we're sitting now on 57th Street was above the blackout area, but below 46th Street, there was no power for about 4 days and nights, something like that. And a rather extraordinary parable, there were some photographs afterwards of downtown New York in that condition of blackout. But as far as I remember, only one building brilliantly alight, and that was Goldman Sachs.
You can't make that stuff up.
Well, I thought, you know, as a kind of perfect image of the present, there it is. So that experience of being here in the hurricane sort of fed into this, because I had this idea of these two worlds that had, you know, a world of the supernatural, of kind of fairies, let's say fairyland. The Indian word Paristan literally translates as fairyland. Pari means fairy. You know,
so. Well, you use both terms interchangeably.
Yeah. Wait, they just, one is the translation of the other. You know, but the idea that there's this supernatural world and our world, which once in the time of the ancient stories, maybe had a little more interaction. But my idea was that over the millennia, somehow the doorways between the two worlds had got blocked You know, and then this colossal series of natural phenomena, like superstorms, you know, kind of breaks the seals, and the supernatural world re-enters our world. The hurricane in the novel is not Sandy. It's more like a kind of super Sandy.
Well, there's a lot of super whatever. There's a president of the United States who is kind of Obama.
Well, he has big ears. That's all. I do not specify his race.
By that point, you're able to go full blown. So there are references to Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie.
That was because, you know, I mean, like halfway through writing the novel, I suddenly thought, oh my God, I'm actually writing I Dream of Jeannie. And not entirely a happy realization, you know, because it's got a djinn princess right. who falls in love with first one and much later another mortal man. I mean, to that extent, there's an echo, but it's in other ways very unlike because she doesn't see him as her master.
Salman Rushdie, let's tackle the djinn part of this because there's a lot of information about this djinn world, and I kept wondering what relationship this has to historical stories about genies and how much is Salman Rushdie just going off?
It's about half and half. Okay. You know, I mean, I think I did do a lot of reading. And one of the things that interested me about the literature about the djinn is that the djinn are not necessarily religious. And there are plenty of djinn who don't believe in God. And I thought that's very interesting. So the existence of fairyland does not prove the existence of paradise. It's just another place where people are as skeptical about the divine as we are or might be. So I thought that was interesting to separate it because the stories of the djinn mainly come from the Islamic tradition, although there are Indian Hindu tales of the djinn as well, you know, it's easy to sort of somehow see it as being a part of that, you know, but actually it's oddly not. In some ways, these stories are much older than Islam. That was good because I wanted in a way to separate this group of people, this group of beings, you know, from, if you like, from religion and just to talk about them as themselves. So that was true. The descriptions of the djinn about the different kinds, you know, the kinds that fly and the kinds that slither and et cetera, that's all there in the literature. What I added, if you like, I added the sex.
A lot of it.
I certainly, the idea of, you know, what do you do in fairyland? You know, you don't go to the movies, you know. I can't imagine there being fairy movie production companies. There are no books in fairyland. There's no publishing industry. So what they do is they have sex. They have inexhaustible, endless sex. And they're kind of over it. And I think one of the things that I sort of liked about the way in which they developed in my mind was that they were more interested in human life than even they liked to let on. Because human life's more interesting. You know, it's more varied. It's more complicated. And so they want to be back in the world of men and women because they like it, you know. And then of course, because their nature is ranging from mischievous to malevolent, they want to screw it up because that's what they do. It was very enjoyable, I must say. I think one of the things about developing an alternate world, you know, whoever does it, is you have to know a lot more than you say. I mean, I think that's, you know, one of the things that makes Tolkien so enduring is that he did so much work on the architecture of his world. You know, he invented languages and cultures, histories, literatures, you know, for all these different beings. And then he wrote the books out of that knowledge rather than putting all that knowledge in the book. I wanted to really feel that I knew the world of the djinn. I mean, I obviously wanted to convince the reader that the real world, that New York City and so on, you know, was properly evoked. If you like, I wanted this imaginary world to have the same level of solidity as this world, as this city outside the window.
You're listening to an interview with Salman Rushdie, whose latest novel is 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. At one point, there's a reference to Asimov's foundation. trilogy, and some other references to a series. There's actually a series of science fiction writers that are listed. Fred Paul.
L. Sprague de Camp.
Yes.
Yes, all of those people.
All the people I interviewed in the 70s yeah, and 80s.
And I was, you know, I was a great addict of that so-called golden age science fiction. But actually, there is a story. I mean, it's impossible to substantiate that Osama bin Laden was a fan of Asimov's Foundation series.
Really?
And the word foundation translated into Arabic is Al-Qaeda. Think about that.
Well, you kind of bring in Afghanistan at one point, but then again you bring in
there's a sentence somewhere in the book where it says that if you write a fairy tale, you're writing about the real world. You know, if you write about the past, you're writing about the present.
One of the jinn decides to take over a country called A, which is Afghanistan, and institute Asimov's foundation. Yeah, exactly. So well, that's right there.
No, that's because I read this thing which alleged that bin Laden had been an admirer. I'm not sure that Asimov would have been delighted.
Probably not, but what it also means in terms of your writing the book, of course, is that you're taking the knowledge of those years reading science fiction and fantasy during 50s and 60s back into your own literature.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's two reasons for that. One is I was interested in science fiction anyway as a form, you know, and in a way I started there, you know, my first novel, Grimus, is sort of is in that zone, you know, and so it's been a long circle back. But also I thought that one of the reasons why I liked science fiction when I started reading it was that it seemed to me to connect to this Eastern group of stories, of which the Arabian Nights is the most famous, but by no means the only one, which I grew up with. You know, so it was a way, a kind of discourse, a way of talking that I was familiar with from another literary tradition. So I've always had the interest in bringing those two things, you know, together. I also think this, that I think one of the things that's really interesting about American literature right now is the way in which a new wave of stories from elsewhere have begun to become American stories. You know, that's to say, you now have, who shall I say, like Junot Diaz bringing stories in from the Dominican Republic, or Nam Le bringing stories in from Vietnam, or Yi Yun Lee from China, or Jhumpa Lahiri from India, Bengal, Bangladesh. And all of this, I think, has enormously enriched this generation of American literature, you know, because it's always been a literature that has gained a lot of traction from immigrant stories, you know, whether Jewish, Yiddish stories, you know, or Italian stories or whatever it might be. Now there's this whole bunch of new immigrant stories becoming American literature. And I kind of thought, well, I could do that too. So, you know, I thought I've got some stories from somewhere else. You know, let's see what happens if I bring those stories over.
At what point did the title come?
Oh, quite early, because I just find myself thinking, what is that, 1001 Nights? You know, what is that in English? and I started working it out. And then I got pleased to find that inside this legendary symmetrical number, there's another pleasing number, 2-8-28, you know, 2 years, 8 months, 28 nights. So there's another kind of shapely number concealed inside the famous one. I mean, you know, in the publishing company, they seem to call it 2828 for short, as people on the internet have already been happy to point out to me, as if I didn't know, that it only works if there isn't a leap year.
The central character, Dunia, you have to develop her as not Genie of I Dream of Genie.
Yeah.
But halfway through, when you realize that there was that connection, did you work extra hard to try to break it?
No, I mean, she had by then established herself quite clearly in my head. I mean, she's a leader, you know. I mean, she becomes the leader of the resistance, if you like, to the attack on the earth by her dark others, you know, all of whom she's probably had sex with at some point. But, you know, that's just like blowing your nose. No, she was very clear to me, and the thing that became very significant to me in the way her character developed was something that it showed about the nature of love, you know, which is that she's in love with this philosopher, Ibn Rushd, in the 12th century, who, of course, being mortal, dies. 800 years later and more, she meets his descendant, who is also hers, I mean, great, 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 whatever, grandson. One of the things about my genies is that they have no incest taboo. But what she sees in him is an echo of the love that she's lost, and that becomes an attraction. Genies are kind of metamorphic beings. So she makes herself look like his dead wife. So he's also lost a great love. And I thought there's something there about love that I really wanted to write about, which is that, you know, all of us, I think, who are not 16 years old, have probably lost something or someone that they deeply cared about and loved, you know. And maybe it's a thing that we do in life, is to look for something that fills that hole, you know, looks for something that feels like it's that shape, the shape of the lost person. And that maybe our relationships, our close relationships, which follow loss, are an attempt to heal the loss, you know, and that we look for surrogates, you know, we look for versions of what we ceased to have. That became a kind of serious thing to write about, you know, which arising out of the way her character developed. So no, I really didn't think of anybody wiggling their nose at all.
Salman Rushdie, there's one other element, which is the battle between Al-Ghazali and Ibn Rushd, or Averroes, and somewhere sitting on my shelf, actually in my bedroom, is a copy of The Incoherence of the Philosophers.
Yes, Ghazali's famous book. And you know, in a way, Ghazali's book is the one that won the battle, because it's the more, if you like, irrationalist. Basically, the argument between the philosophers was between Ghazali, who believed that God was all-powerful and not bound by natural laws, and there was no point discussing it because that was just his nature, as opposed to Ibn Rushd, who was from a line of philosophers very influenced by, for example, Aristotle, who believed that you should be able to include reason and logic and scientific principle into your understanding of the divine. His view would certainly have been that, you know, as it were, once God has made the world, that the laws of nature that he has set in place then apply, that they apply even to him. And so that question about whether God is limited in his power by the natural world or not, you know, became in a way the beginning of a great battle between modernism and what we now call fundamentalism. Inside the Islamic tradition, we see the battle today.
Ibn Rushd, could he have been an ancestor?
No, but he's somebody that my father admired a lot and therefore changed our family name.
Really?
Yeah. My grandfather wasn't called Rushdie. My father changed the family name to Rushdie because of his admiration for Averroes. And that's where my interest originally came from. You know? And then I found myself also very attracted to him as a thinker, you know, and there's a thing about him which I do feel very personally, which is that he had a strange fate. I mean, there was a period, as the book describes, when he was exiled because of fanatics, you know, and his books were burned, something I also recall. And I mean, in his life, he was reinstituted and regained his positions of prestige during his lifetime. But the strange thing is that his philosophy, his ideas subsequently over these many centuries have not been hugely influential inside the Muslim world, but they have been hugely influential outside it. I mean, like Thomas Aquinas was very affected by Ibn Rushd. The Renaissance humanist philosophers, out of whom our modern ideas come, you know, were very affected by him. So he's had this enormous influence outside his own culture, but not inside it. One of the things that I do feel very painfully is that something like that happened to me. That there's, you know, if you look around, if you read what's out there, there are basically two descriptions of me. You know, there's a description of me as being worthless and horrible and et cetera, and to be dismissed and to be treated as a kind of devil and ignored, you know. And then there's a, you know, fortunately, there's a slightly more respectful version available in other parts of the world. I find that to be a source of sadness. I know what it's like to be read outside the world I came from and to be proscribed in quite large sections of the world that I came from. So in that sense, I feel that what happened to him is an echo of what happened, I mean, or pre-echo. I'm an echo of what happened to him.
after all this time, I mean, I know that if I had been in a position like you were, say, 15, 20 years ago, the fact that this person here who eats, goes to the bathroom, reads, watches television, is somehow being used as this massive symbol, it would probably have overwhelmed me. How used to it are you, or are you not?
I don't think you do get used to it. I don't like it. And I think the problem with the symbol is that it's on both sides. You know, it's, right. It's either a negative symbol or a positive symbol, but it's still, I don't feel like a symbol. I feel actual. In many ways, I think it's the work that saves me, you know, because writing, you know, it's really hard to do. And it obliges you. I mean, if you're going to do it at all well, I think it obliges you to have a fairly clear sense of yourself. You know? You have to know who you're writing from. And I think I felt as a young man starting out to write, it took me a while to answer that question for myself, you know, because of the disruptions of my early life between India, Pakistan, England. You know, identity becomes something you have to really think about. And I think I'm clearer about it now. And oddly, it's also a time in which identity has become this very politicized thing, you know. And oddly, that's a way of narrowing identity. You know, identity politics is a way of asking people to define themselves narrowly as one thing. Whereas one of the things that I learned about identity through my own inward-looking self-examination was that identity is by its nature very multiple. We are a lot of people. You know, we are a kind of bag of selves, and some of those selves are contradictory to other parts. You know, do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself, you know, as Whitman famously said. And I think that's true, and I think one of the things we now understand about human nature is that it is multiple, changeable, you know, mutable, metamorphic, and often contradictory. And so I've become very interested in that idea. The idea, I mean, this is a novel, and several of my novels deal with the nature of metamorphosis, the nature of transformation and change and so on. And it's because I think that is what we're like. We are creatures who change. You know, we mutate and we contradict ourselves. And so I want to write about us like that. You know, not as if you like a kind of pre-Freudian writer would have written about the self as being a very solid, immutable thing. You know, I think the self now is a much, we have to re-understand it.
But we also have to find ways to define on some level who we are and who others are, which becomes problematic if everybody is changing at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think that's, you know, a lot of the trouble in the world comes from that. But I think most of us would say we know who we are, let's say, as the parents of our children. We know who we are as the friends of our friends. You know, we know who we are as the members of our workplace. And maybe we know who we are in a broader sense. Maybe we know who we are in, if you like, tribal terms. You know, we know who we are in national terms. We have a sense of our relationship to our country or not. And I think it's become now quite natural for us to understand ourselves as plural. You know, we see that the way we are with our children is not the way we are with our buddies, you know, and we don't see a problem with that. So I think we've learned, all of us, that the self is this. It's contradictory. And the problem arises precisely because there's an attempt to straitjacket us, you know, to try and say we are this or that. You know, we are Western or Islamic or Jewish or whatever it might be. And that's all that we are. And out of that comes conflict.
On top of that, for you in particular, there's also who you are, all of these roles, and then there's this Rushdie person, yeah.
You know, I think the problem with that Salman Rushdie person, I think it puts people off reading my books.
Really?
You know, yeah. I think people have this sense of me as whatever it is, positive or negative, but not really as literary. So a thing that often happens when people, I mean, I get a lot of this kind of thing, when people read my books for the first time, for whatever reason, so they decide to pick up a book. Right. Very often I get these letters of surprise, which is, you know, who knew that you were a real writer? You know, I mean, who knew that you were funny? Who knew that you were good? All those ordinary judgments that people make about books and writers somehow get swept aside by this iconization, you know, and I think it's actually bad for me. It's bad for me as a writer.
My nephew the other day said to me, you know, I really didn't like Midnight's Children that much, but I know that this is weird, but I really loved Satanic Verses, and I'm going, why is that weird?
No, I mean, I think one of the great things about the Satanic Verses is that now, whatever it is, more than a quarter of a century later, it's finally, I think, allowed to be a book instead of being a hot potato. It's finally allowed to have people read it as a book and decide whatever they decide, you know. And I mean, some people love it, some people kind of think it's okay, and some people don't like it much. And that is the ordinary life of a book. And for a long time, that book in particular, and to an extent all my books, were not allowed to have the ordinary life of a book. And it's great to be back on the book pages, you know what I mean?
My nephew said that. My response is, well, of course, you know, that you're going to like one book more than another. What difference does that make?
Yeah, no, you know, I like Great Expectations more than David Copperfield. Right. So what? I mean, I still enormously admire Dickens. It's just there are things about Copperfield, particularly childhood things, that I find sentimental. And what I like about by the time he's got to writing Great Expectations, that the sentimentality is all gone. That, like, you know, Pip in Great Expectations is a very flawed character and therefore much more modern to my liking than Copperfield, you know, who is kind of sweet little kid much put upon.
Because of, I guess, the celebrity element, the good part of it is you get to be on places like Bill Maher and give your opinion. I mean, there is a positive there. You get restaurant reservations.
Yes, yes. Tables in restaurants and, you know, seats at Yankees games. Yeah. Yeah. It's not all bad. That's true. And no, the thing is, I think I'm not bad at television. You know, truthfully, I think there's a lot of writers who go on talk shows and are good at it and a lot who are not good at it. You know, and I think for whatever reason, maybe because of a kind of thespian background or whatever, I'm not bothered by being on camera. You know, I mean, I feel as relaxed on camera as off camera.
Thespian background. You were in plays? You were an actor?
When I was at university, I did a lot of, I certainly did more work in student theater than trying to write when I was at Cambridge. You know, and even after I left university, you know, there was in those days in the late 60s, early 70s, a very creative London fringe theatre that I was quite actively involved in, and which out of which came a lot of the people that you would now think of as the leading figures in British theatre, like, you know, David Hare, Howard Brenton, and Trevor Griffiths, et cetera. So all these very good writers cutting their teeth on the fringe. So the quality of work was, you know, interesting. Anyway, I did a lot of acting, and I mercifully saw the light, but I did briefly toy with tried to be an actor. So I'm afraid the world has been deprived of that. I do feel a little bit that that's a kind of unscratched itch.
And also, because of all of the rest of this, it allows you to have a public persona.
No, but I mean, I actually really liked acting. Being yourself is one thing, but being somebody else is more interesting. I think it's sort of why I write fiction, because it's more interesting for me to enter into the way of thinking of other people than to simply put myself out there.
Well, I've talked to enough writers who say, you know, talk about the relationship between being an actor and being a writer, even to a point where it might make sense for a writer to take an acting class.
Well, it's not by accident that both the main characters in the Satanic Verses are actors. I do think there's a performance element even to the written word. I mean, you're writing things that you want people to be engrossed by and read. And so you have to do it in a way that they listen.
I interviewed Lee Grant, the actress, a couple of weeks ago. And by the way, she's almost 90, totally awesome. But at one point she said, and I think it does apply to writers, she said, you know, what Shirley MacLaine says about living all of these lives, she says, I've lived them in all my roles in my one lifetime. And I think a writer does the same thing.
I agree. I mean, you know, a question that writers are often asked is the question about solitude. You know, I mean, how do you deal with having to be on your own so much? And my answer is I don't feel like I'm on my own. You know, I mean, I need the door shut and nobody to come in, but I feel immersed in a place and in a crowd of people, you know, I often think about my way of working about character, not so much as a process of making as is a process of listening. You know, I mean, I get a kind of clue about a character, and then what I feel I do is try and listen to them. You know, let me hear what you have to tell me. What do you want to say about yourself? You know, and also just how people speak, because I think how people speak tells you an enormous amount about who they are. Are they garrulous? Are they taciturn? Do they use a lot of bad language? What kind of accent do they have? In England, of course, that would reveal social class as right. well. I mean, less so here. It would more reveal regionality
right.
here. Anyway, the point is you ask yourself, or you ask your character who's coming out of the egg these questions, and by the time you know those answers, you already know a lot about them. Are they funny? Are they sad?
You know, one thing that I hit on with a lot of writers is the relation to who is doing the writing, the character or the writer. And a lot of writers will say, oh, that's a joke to say that the character took over. Mm-hmm. But on some level, when you ask these questions and the answers come, mm-hmm. the nature of the answers to that degree determines yeah. the character.
Yeah, it does. It's obviously, you know, in reality, inaccurate to say that the character takes over because you're writing all the sentences,
right.
you know, but many of us have that feeling sometimes that something comes alive on a page and goes in a direction you weren't expecting. And then you find that interesting, you know, and you follow that direction. The way I would put it is I think that when I'm involved in the act of writing and only when I'm involved in the act of writing, my mind works in a little bit slightly different way. You know, it doesn't work in the way that it ordinarily, like, it doesn't work the way it's working now, you know. Other things, other doors open in the head, and you find yourself thinking thoughts on behalf of characters, you know, thinking thoughts that you've never thought or that are not the way you think, you know. And that's, I think, what people mean when they say that the character takes over, because you have to be able to convincingly enter the minds of people who are not like you.
Gardeners.
Yeah. Otherwise, yeah, you don't want to, don't let me loose in anybody's garden, you know, because I can't, you know, my view of gardens is like red flower here, yellow flower there, big tree, medium-sized tree. You know, that's about what I know. But for that reason, it became very enjoyable to learn about Mr. Geronimo, because I wanted somebody who loved the earth, who literally physically loved the physical earth, and then couldn't touch it, and that becomes both his comedy and his tragedy, if you like. You know, it's what makes him poignant in the story, because he's somebody who spent his life loving the earth. And for such a person to be separated from it is, you know, it's funny, but it's painful.
Salman Rushdie, now that you've written this, a couple of quick questions. First of all, you did write the screenplay for Midnight's Children.
Yes.
But you mentioned having been an actor. Have you given thought to playwriting?
I have. I'm kind of puzzled by the fact that I haven't done it already, because I love the theater. I think it's very, very difficult. I think it may be even more difficult to write a good play than a good novel, because when a play is not amazing, it's awful. There's like nothing in the middle. You know, when the play isn't working on you, you're sitting in this place trapped in the middle of a row, unable to escape for a couple of hours while people are, you know, doing stuff on a stage in front of you, and it's unbearable. And every so often when it works, it's like incredible magic. You know, and I think, you know, I am part of the universal acclaim for Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton, which is everything that people say it is. It's magically good. It's, I think, best thing I've seen on a stage in New York in, I don't know how long, 10 years. So with that, when it works, it's of astonishing power. And it almost never happens. Whereas a book can be kind of okay and it's still enjoyable. A movie can be kind of garbage, but it's got great special effects. That's all right. I mean, I think we settle for less. In the theater, when you're actually physically sitting there with the people doing stuff with the invisible fourth wall, it has to be astonishing or it's unbearable. But yeah, I would like to write a play. I would like to write a play before I'm done, so maybe.
I talked to Craig Lucas, who's a playwright, and I asked him, would you write a novel? And he gave a completely different answer. He said no, because a novel is solitary, whereas if a play is going to work, it has to be...
It's collaborative.
Collaborative. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things I enjoyed about doing the screenplay, that it was such a change of pace because a screenplay is totally collaborative. A screenplay, after all, is only a step on the way to the film, you know, and you have to see it as that. And so it's not just your imagination that you're thinking about, but the director has an imagination, and you have to find the common ground, you know, et cetera. So, no, I mean, yeah, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that. And I think it would be enjoyable to do a bit more collaborative work. Yeah. But the other thing that happens, you know, and I've become very aware of it with the passing of the years, is that you begin to realize that the future is not infinite, that the amount of time available is limited. I think that's a good thing to know, because what it does is it clarifies your thinking into doing the things that you think are really, that you really, really want to do while you have the time to do them. So don't mess around, you know, don't waste time. So, I mean, I'm glad I did the kind of Showtime exercise, but, you know, I'm not going to spend another 2 years wasting time with Hollywood. Somebody wants to make a film in one of my books, great. You know, give me the money, take a book, make the film. But I've really come around to thinking, I like the solitude. You know, I like the being in a room with myself. As I say, I don't feel solitary. I feel surrounded by a crowd. And I think maybe that's why I haven't done more theater or television or film. It's because in the end, my nature is more to just sit in a room and do it. You know, and I think so. I think, you know, my view is that that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do the day job.
What are you working on now?
You know, one of the things I've felt is that I've regretted not having written more short stories. I got 3 or 4 different short stories that I've got 4 or 5 pages of each. I want to finish those, which is probably as much as I can do this year, what with book tours and so on. I do have a little germ of a next thing that might be a book. And it's beginning to, I don't even know what it is yet. You know, I only have a vague sense of its shape and of 3 characters. And I don't even understand them properly yet. You know, so, but I mean, there's something happening, which will happen, but it won't happen until next year.
You've been listening to an interview with Salman Rushdie, whose latest novel is 2 Years, 8 Months, and 28 Nights. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.